This episode of Section D was first broadcast on Tuesday, the 11th of September on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexis. Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. Regular listeners will hopefully remember that last week's show came to you from the 13th Venice Architecture Biennale. Well, given the spectacular showcase of global architecture continues until the 25th of November, we stuck around a little longer, and this week's show is part two of the people and projects at the forefront of the global architecture industry, currently camping in Venice. Coming up, we speak to the curators at the very first Angolan Pavilion and find out how one clever plant could solve the problem of Africa's urban sprawl.
They filter dirty water, they grow 1 meter a month and they can be cropped and transformed into biomass. The people that have these gardens or that will have these gardens could crop their own plants and then produce their own energy.
At the British Pavilion, we hear how lessons could be learned from the Dutch about floating houses.
We've always been inspired by the waterways and how they could be used for something other than transport, especially in London where we feel it's so underused.
And we bob about on a seesaw with the curator of the Irish Pavilion.
We're interested in looking at was in measure, in scale, in general, which is such an important concept in architecture, but we use the seesaw as a way that something that people can interact with.
Elsewhere, we learn why Rolex is adding an architecture program to its mentoring scheme. We find out what it's like to be a young architect in Romania. And we pull up a paper pew in a cardboard creation by the Taiwanese in a former jail. That's all to come on this week's Venice Architecture Biennale special edition of Section D. The most talked about debut pavilion at this year's Biennale was from Angola. It was the first time that a sub-Saharan country had participated in the Biennale. And, over on the island of San Giorgio Maggiore, we entered a room filled with a leafy, rustling plant, rather like bamboo. The plant is called Arundodonax, and it could just hold the key to relieving the dismal urban development, not just in Luanda, Angola's capital, but across other urban regions in Africa too. Nestled among the tall plants, I sat down with curators Stefano Raboli Pansera and Paola Nascimento to hear how.
Well, this is the island of San Giorgio Maggiore in Venice. It was designed, the church was designed by Palladio. There is a beautiful cloister close to us, and is a place full of history. We wanted to copy a fragment of Kazenga, the area of investigation in Luanda, inside the room, the Sala Carneluti, where we are, and we didn't want to touch anything of the existing. And this is part of our sensibility, because we want really to change everything by changing nothing. And the idea is that we rebuild a one-to-one scale prototype of our intervention in Kazenga, in Venice.
And what does that consist of? Because you say that you built a one-in-one scale prototype, but there's no buildings here. We're actually standing in what looks like a very beautiful garden.
We rebuilt the footprint of the buildings, which are actually the void, and we focused on the common ground, which for us is this energetic garden that morphs its function and also its role within the city. It's basically a garden composed of a certain type of plants, Arundodonax, that perform several functions in the city. They have thin roots and they filter dirty water. They grow 1 meter a month and they can be cropped and transformed into biomass. And ideally, the people that have these gardens or that will have these gardens could crop their own plants and then sell the plant or sell the energy or produce their own energy.
So it's an amazing solution that seems incredibly simple for raising the quality of life of the inhabitants of Luanda, because Luanda is not known necessarily for its quality of life at the moment. How feasible is this that it could be implemented?
The proposal is very feasible. I would like to see that the common ground becomes a shared resource for the city, because the space in between the building provides the sewage and the electricity for each family that lives in the neighborhood. This is a proposal which is very feasible. The technology that we propose has already been implemented in other African countries and even outside Africa. Our contribution consists in the fact that we offer a critique to the typology of the garden, which is not really leisure, but is a garden and infrastructure simultaneously.
What's it mean for there to be a presence of Angola here in Venice? We were talking a little earlier about how sub-Saharan African cities or countries are really not represented here at all.
To me it's a bit of a surprise not to have any emerging countries really represented here. Angola is a country that it's obviously been talked about for many reasons, and I think that it's quite important that it's placed also on a cultural level and it's seen as a country that can produce things and solutions and also be part of the architectural discourse. At the moment, we're in a phase of rebuilding the country, and therefore every proposal and every opportunity to be at the forefront of the new discussions of what's happening and the future of the cities, it's a big contribution to the country.
Arguably, it has more place here than any other country or city in that respect, and that it's a ground for experimentation of sort of a new way of living. What's next then for this project?
The next step is that we are going to have a meeting with the local authorities and the researchers, because the project is in a way very complex and very controversial, although the impact is very limited. For example, there are many legal issues, many anthropological issues, many cultural issues that we want to tackle. And we are going to have a symposium in Venice in November, when we are going to discuss about the details for the implementation of the proposal in Luanda next year. Or in Luanda or in Angola, because it doesn't have to be necessarily in the center of the city, but it can be in other, even remote villages, far from any other infrastructure, that we could make self-sufficient with this infrastructure, with this new common ground.
That was Stefano Raboli Pansera and Paola Nascimento, curators of Angola's debut participation in Venice. And from the dry African plains to the wet flats of the Netherlands, British Architecture Practice, DRMM, conducted a study of Dutch floating houses as part of the British Pavilion. The British show was called Venice Takeaway, and it charged a selection of UK practices to visit different countries and see what lessons could be learnt from techniques abroad to answer the problems faced back home. Here's Isabel Pietri from DRMM explaining how and why we might soon be living on water in Britain.
We got selected to be part of this global research project in March, April this year. And our plan was to go to the Netherlands to find out what is it about the Dutch that has created all this fearless engineering and planning.
The crazy Dutch.
Yes, which we thought it would be something great to inject into the UK at this point in time, especially looking at the housing crisis in the UK and what possible sort of lateral thinking solutions we could propose.
So just to rewind a little bit, the project, or rather the exhibition here, is called Venice Takeaway.
Yes.
And the British Council commissioned a whole load of entries to be submitted for architecture practices in the UK to go abroad, learn a lesson and bring it back. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. So we've always been inspired by the waterways and how they could be used for something other than transport, especially in London, where we feel that it's so underused. What triggered our interest in this competition was the fact that it's such a U-turn from what the pavilion is always about. So this time it's more about looking outside to see what we could learn and sort of interacting with other countries, as opposed to the usual pavilion style of showing how great we are. We're doing it. We're doing it still, but in a slightly different way.
It's very modest. And so you were then provided with a grant to travel to the Netherlands and investigate floating architecture.
Yes. So we got a modest travel grant and we had to make the most out of it. So we spent 4 action-packed days in Eiburg, which is a floating community in Amsterdam, 15 minutes away from Amsterdam. And we wanted to immerse ourselves in this floating community, like method actors really lived in there with the family and spoke to a lot of people to really see what it's like to live in such a place. It's a pioneering community, group of people that are testing out these floating houses. It's a leap from the classic boat houses that you see all over Amsterdam and in the UK and all over the world. It's modeled on Sausalito in California and also using the typical Dutch, what they call gazelligheid. I can't possibly pronounce it. But it's something to do with a general feeling of coziness or a feeling of togetherness, of place, of being in a familiar place, which is something that they've tried to incorporate in the master plan of this floating community.
And, I mean, they're floating communities, but they are fixed to the sort of waterbed. It's not as if you wake up with seasickness every morning.
In a different country. No, it's it works very much like a marina. So you have the jetties through which all the services travel to the houses, which are plugged in along the jetties, pretty much as boats. The jetties are also public space, so in the very Dutch style, you know, you can see anyone walking in front of your window while you're having breakfast, and all the neighbors kind of, you can see across each other's house. And it's quite a brilliant, like, sense of freedom, and you know, you're surrounded by water. They really made use of the qualities of the water instead of using it as a kind of side thing. It's you can fish from your house, from your living room. You can dive into the water in summer. You can feed the swans. In winter, you can ice skate around your house. Mm. So, and you really get a feeling that all these people are super tight-knit community-wise, and it's brilliant. I mean, obviously, it's a pioneering development, so there's a lot of things that could be improved.
And that you have then brought back this sort of concept of living and floating on water and being able to build on water and create a community there. Are we all going to be living on floating housing projects soon in the UK, do you think?
Well, I think it's inevitable, and I think it's a matter of biting the bullet now rather than later. They're already years ahead of us in that sense, because they already have an issue with water, where one third of the country is below sea level. So they're used to this idea that, you know, there are rooms below sea level and services travel upwards, you know, which is complete. It would be tricky to, like, bring that mentality into the UK.
And of course, this is a very appropriate exhibition and discussion to be having in Venice, which is floating.
Yes, absolutely. I think it's inevitable. I mean, it's for example, in the Netherlands, they've been pumping the water away for hundreds of years, and now they're taking on a process that they call depolarizing Holland, which means flooding back the country and making use of the water, either for living or for energy, because they realize that with the crazy weather patterns, they can no longer pump out the water enough, so they have to resort to it. And I think this will inevitably take on in different parts of the world, and the UK being one of them, where right now there's already, you know, housing being built in flood zones, which creates a lot of damages, which are irreversible for the people who've lost their houses. Mm. And it's difficult for them to get mortgage in the flood zone. Insurance-wise, it's a huge issue. So floating housing really tackles it in a way that there is a change in the regulations. There needs to be a change in terms of the ownership of water. We're looking at the Royal Docks as a possible site because it's a perfect controlled environment, which is very underused. It's right in the center of London. It's about densifying the city, you know, you're making use of the infrastructure that is already there and avoiding urban sprawl. So that's what you saw the film of, a kind of future domestic journey into the Royal Docks. We took one floating terrace from one of the houses in Amsterdam. They have no trees, no nature. All their nature is floating. And it's kind of hinting at, you know, what could be, you know, in the UK. We could start here as a sort of micro development, which slowly starts to make people think that this could be possible. Because initially you think floating house, you probably, you know, get dizzy. But it's incredible. They're incredibly stable and pleasant to be in. It really has the dimensions of a house. Mm. You really forget that you're in a boat. Well, is it a boat or a house? You know, it's always that question. People always refer to them as boats, but they're not really boats.
Mm. So the future is floating.
Yes, absolutely.
That was Isabel Pietri from DRMM Architects in the British Pavilion. Time for a short break, but stay tuned. We'll be hearing about Rolex's Architecture Mentor Scheme after this.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus. Creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Inspirational mayors, money-making gentrifiers, park creators, subway planners, tech hub upstarts, wayfinding geniuses, broom-toting road sweepers, stadium designers, all-seeing historians, and squawking birds. If they help make a city, you'll meet them on The Urbanist, Monocle's weekly show about the cities we live in that's presented by me, Andrew Tuck.
That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to a Venice Architecture Biennale special here on Section D. Swiss watchmakers Rolex chose the Biennale to announce a new strand to its mentor and protege arts initiative. No surprises that the new discipline is architecture, and the inaugural mentor is none other than Japanese superstar Kazuyo Tsujima of SANA, the former Biennale director and architect behind the Rolex Learning Centre in Lausanne. I caught up with Rebecca Irvin, head of philanthropy at Rolex, to find out more.
This program started 10 years ago in five disciplines originally: dance, music, literature, theatre arts, and visual arts. And we wanted it to serve all the arts and to be global. And very quickly, after a few years, we had an advisory board who suggested that we split film away from theatre arts. So we set it up as a separate category. Now what's happened in architecture, it's the same thing. It's been some time, for many years, several of our advisory boards have been saying you should really recognize architecture as a separate artistic discipline, do a mentorship in architecture. 10 years ago, when we started this program, our first visual arts mentor was Alvaro Siza, who today received the Golden Lion for Lifetime Achievement, which makes us very proud. And he's a wonderful man, he's been a wonderful mentor, and he's a wonderful architect. So we were beyond the point where we could really consider architecture as a form of visual arts. It's very close, but it really deserved its own category, its own separate discipline. So now we have seven. So the Rolex Mentoring Program now is dealing with dance, film, music, literature, theater, visual arts, and architecture.
And how does the program work? There's a board that selects a possible mentor, and then a separate board that selects a possible protege. How does that process come about?
Well, maybe let me start by saying that this is a mentoring program where we're pairing great world artists with younger talents, emerging artists. So the protégés are young professionals. They're not students. They tend to be in, let's say, in their 30s or so, early 30s, depending on the discipline, of course. But this is a program where we're pairing a great world artist with a young emerging talent, and they're actually collaborating in whichever way they want over the period of a year. So at the heart of this program is really a personal relationship, the idea behind it being to transmit personally from on a one-to-one relationship an artistic heritage and artistic knowledge. And it's over the years we've discovered that this is really an interesting conversation because it's an exchange. It's an exchange across generations, across cultures. And the mentors have told us that they get out, you know, a lot out of it, sometimes as much, if not more, than the protégés.
And so the first mentor of architecture you announced yesterday is Kazuo Sajima.
That's right.
And she's a lady with a connection to Rolex after Sano built the learning center. But tell us a little bit why you felt that she was the best person to kick the architecture program off.
Well, I'll go back to your previous question about how it works. So to recruit the mentors, we put together an advisory board of artistic leaders and artists, and they recommend to us who they think would make good mentors. And to start this discipline of architecture, we got together a group of architects, including Sir David Chipperfield and others, professional practitioners in the profession, to say who would have the right character, who would be interested in doing this. And they all unanimously endorsed Sajima. And it's true that she had a previous relationship with Rolex, that we were the largest private donor of the Rolex Learning Center, which is on the campus of the EPFL in Lausanne, the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology. That it's a public building. It was made mainly with public funds, but it happens to have our name on it because we were the largest private donor to that building. And so we have a relationship with Sajima that goes back for some years, and we know her well. She's a wonderful architect and a wonderful person, and this was kind of a natural thing for us to invite her to be a mentor in our program.
And next up is to select the lucky apprentice or protege. How does that happen?
Well, we spoke to Sajima about how she saw this mentorship and what kind of protégé she would like. We tried to define with each mentor the profile of the person they would like to work with. And we put together a nominating panel. This is a mini board of five or six specialists in the field who know young talents, who themselves curate or look for young talents and who can judge young talents. They nominate candidates. These candidates then submit their credentials. And the nominators meet to narrow down the field to three finalists. And the three finalists are then presented to the mentor, and she would choose from these three finalists.
And they get to work together for a year. But this is a little unusual in the architecture discipline in that Sajima already has a project for the protégé to work on her with. And in fact, it's the subject of the Japanese pavilion that's just been awarded Best Pavilion at the Golden Lions. So very high profile already. Tell us about that.
Usually the mentor and protege are free to interact in any way they want over the mentoring year. We just ask that they spend at least 60 days together over the period of a year. And some mentors and proteges have actually done projects together. Usually it's much more open than this, and they kind of decide as they go along. Sajima came to us with a very specific request. She said, could my protege work on this Home for All project, which is rebuilding community centers in tsunami-affected areas of Japan? And so she actually came with a very specific idea, not just for the profile of the protege, the level of experience and the character, but somebody who would actually be able to work on this project in Japan. So it's very interesting and it's very exciting. It's a wonderful opportunity for a young architect, not just to work with her, but to work on a specific project that has so much meaning. I'm thrilled that Toyo Ito and the Japanese Pavilion has got the Golden Lion for this project, because it's about architecture that really has deep significance and meaning as well. So we're very pleased about that, but that's just the icing on the cake for us.
And what happens next then? When does the protege get announced, and when will they start?
Well, the panel is actually meeting now in secret here in Venice, because several of the nominators were actually here anyway. And by the end of the day, they should have three finalists who will be taken by us, by Rolex, in the next month or so to Japan to meet Sajima. She'll see their work and their files and their work samples and their motivation. And we then take the finalists to the mentor, and she will talk to them or do whatever she wants to do with them to take a decision. So we're hoping to announce the protégé in early October.
That was Rebecca Irvin, with the charming title of Head of Philanthropy at Rolex. And on the subject of time, here's Gypsy and the Cat with Time to Wander. That was Time to Wander by Gypsy and the Cat. You're listening to a Venice Architecture Biennale special edition of Section D here on Monocle 24. Now, over at the end of the Arsenale shipyards, the Chileans set up home in a dark little room with crunchy salt heaped on the floor. The show was called Cancha, Chilean Soilscapes. In the exhibition, seven architects had penned essays about Chile's heritage, landscape and resources, which photographer Cristobal Palma interpreted into beautiful films. I caught up with Cristobal outside, away from the salt, to hear all about it.
The pavilion is named Cancha, which translates as ground. And what it tries to do is to get people to think and to think about all the operations that you can have with the ground. Whether it's just marking the ground, whether it's trading ground, whether it's literally moving ground. So seven different architects were invited to talk about this through seven different essays.
Chilean Pavilion has a nice ring to it.
Well, if you say so.
Tell me, what do we find in the Chilean Pavilion this year?
Bilal and Bernardo, the curators, they invited seven architects to write an essay to do with Cancha. So each architect could talk pretty much about wherever they wanted. And so, for instance, Germán del Sol used the word as... He went back to the region of the word and the sort of the Indian take on Cancha. And his essay is more poetical, I suppose. Genaro Cuadra, another architect, he talks about kind of big city developments. Super Sudaca, run by Juan Pablo Corbalán. They talk about a bit of the history of Chile and how Chile has been defined and drawn and has that change over time.
Your role was then, because you were actually a photographer and a filmmaker, yeah. Was to turn these essays into films, is that right?
Yeah, so then after the seven essays were done, basically I had a chat with each architect. And my role was to produce a film that, in one way or another, had something to do with the essay. It didn't have to explain the whole thing. It could just take one aspect of it, and so it could work as a complement and to give a more kind of spatial sense of what they're talking about. So they run I think the shortest is 4 minutes, the longest is 12 minutes. And some of them are more kind of documentary types. Some are more abstract. My background is photography, so I'm not a proper filmmaker, but so yeah, they're quite visual, but they try to tell a story in different ways, through the space, through the sound, or through what people are talking about.
And the whole Biennale is filled with a lot of words. That you go into any pavilion and there's so much to read. You go into the Chilean pavilion and you see these films, which actually, even without reading the essays, you get a real sense of maybe what the idea was behind them. Is that part of the intention, do you think?
Yeah, the intention was to try to make them work in different kind of time frames. So, because one assumes that not everyone's going to stop there for 10 minutes to watch a film. So they have to work also in short periods. But also knowing that eventually we can show them in another format. So that's why you could either just walk from one to the other and just get a kind of quick sense of what they're talking about, or the actual places. It's just to put a picture on what they're talking about. But eventually also we want to find a space that where people can actually sit and watch the whole thing, but
switch off, and also just see actually what Chile looks like, which someone like me who's never been, and for I'm sure many people who are visiting will never have been, it's sort of one of the nicest things is to actually just see buildings and see architecture and sort of get a sense of what it feels like there.
The thing with Chile is that I think for the last 10 years, I suppose, quite a few projects have been published quite a lot in the architectural press. So some people, I mean, do know about specific projects. So the idea of the pavilion was not to concentrate on a specific project, although you can see a couple of actual architectural projects, but the curators wanted to talk more about bigger issues and not just about a single building as such. So that's why it's good in that sense, because one of the films or one of the essays is in the north of Chile, so you get a bit of the desert. Germán del Sol has a lovely project in the south, so you get a bit of rainforest, and Ciudad Abierta is also there in Valparaíso. I think it's a nice introduction to all these different places, different people, different subjects.
Definitely, and just because we're on radio rather than film, I have to point out that you have the most incredible beard. How long has that been in the making?
It's been going on like this for, I don't know, last 3 years, I think 3-4 years. I've got a little boy and he's 4, and I started growing it when he was born, so...
Goodness, can you ever cut it now?
It's becoming harder and harder, I think, because I feel a bit naked if I take it off, but there you go.
That was Cristobal Palma, the heavily bearded photographer and filmmaker behind the Chilean pavilion. Meanwhile, over at the Romanian pavilion in the Giardini, another dark room played host to thousands of stamps of both the male variety and the punching type. Play Minciu was the show's title, a joint nod to the celebrated Romanian architect Ion Minciu and the stifling bureaucracy involved in Romanian architecture too. Curator Laura Yusub had this to say on the topic.
Well, we have a playground, we call it. It starts with a bit of history, and it's about the stamps. When you enter on the left side, you'll have classical postal stamps, which feature a collection of architecture. And we wanted to show how architecture has been officialized and seen by the state and selected to be put on official stamps. In the middle, you have, well, it's sort of an irony. We were using notary stamps and stickers, and you can play and sort of assume that power. Because in Romania, architects don't have as much power as a notary, and they're not as respected, maybe. And in the whole process, that is a problem. And we invite people to take that power in their hands and play with it on their documents, on their moleskins, notebooks, and whatever. And at the end, we have a sonar stamp, which could be like a future interpretation or a transformation of this stamp. And we use the technology of thermal scan, and you can thermal scan images, and you can see it on the wall and hear the noise in the headphones.
And so it's a playful exhibition that people coming can interact with, but it highlights a much sort of deeper problem in Romania, that architects have a lot of bureaucracy when it comes to building projects. Is that right?
Yes, that's very right. There is a lot of bureaucracy. I'm sure maybe not only in Romania, but is for us, this is so it's the backstage of the creative process.
And is this something that architects are really pushing to kind of change in the country?
I don't think so. They just pretend it's not there, and we are artists, you know, but everybody does it, and everybody's so annoyed by it.
But do you find then that young architects in Romania tend to leave the country to work abroad, or is there quite a strong architectural community there?
There are a few offices of young architects that are really good, they're cool, but amongst my generation at least, or my friends and so on, they tend to leave, yes, they tend to leave and work abroad.
And maybe you could tell me a little bit about what you do. Are you from Bucharest?
Yes, I'm from Bucharest, and I finished the master's degree, and now, actually, as we said, I'm looking forward to work abroad.
And maybe one day you will take what you've learned from abroad and bring it back and change the system from within in Romania.
Definitely. I like Romania, and I like Bucharest. I mean, it has a simplicity, maybe a freedom. I like it there, and I think I will come back. I'm not sure by then something will change or someone will tell, because this is bureaucracy. It's an old tradition of ours.
That was Laura Yusub at the Romanian Pavilion there. Time for a short break, but stay tuned. We'll be talking cardboard houses in Taiwan after this.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back to our Venice Architecture Biennale special here on Section D. The Taiwanese took up residence in a former prison next to the Doge's palace. Their show was called Architect Geographer. And walking into the large room, visitors were faced with an intricately constructed cardboard labyrinth in the shape of a home, complete with cardboard furniture and fittings. I pulled up a cardboard chair at a cardboard table with Taiwanese architect Michael Johan Lin to hear what it was all about.
I studied in Taipei, Taiwan, Tonghai University, and then graduate school of design, Harvard in America. And after I went to work in Germany, and I'm in Germany for 15 years already. And I'm practicing in Germany in two different cities, Leipzig and Münster. As well, in Taichung, Taipei, I have three offices.
Out of interest, why the combination between Germany and Taiwan?
Actually, I actually like it. I mean, because, of course, one place is my home, the other place is as well my home, because I have my family there. And this is a continuous issue for me. A lot of people ask me, why don't you go home? But at the beginning, I never know where my home is. At the end, everywhere is my home somehow. So this has become the reason why I want to approach this issue of what is home in this exhibition.
And so we're sitting in the middle of the exhibition, which is in an old jail next to the Doge's palace.
Yeah.
It's sort of quite a sort of powerful symbol.
It's very.
Maybe you could just explain a little bit about what the installation is that you have created here.
It's an uncanny home that you feel home, but you're not home somehow. It's a home that you have this familiar sense of comfort because the furniture, because the space, because the scale of the space, yet at the same time, because this is a public space, you constantly have tourists walking around, that you have strangers occupying the place you feel home somehow. And that was the idea, that this is a very uncanny home. Uncanny in the sense that it's amnestic, meaning that you somehow forgot something, because this is totally out of paper. There's no monument, there's no materiality, everything is monolithic. There's something missing, but you don't know what. You are there, maybe you are here. That was the idea.
And so it's a series of interconnected rooms built from cardboard. And we're sitting in the dining room at the moment with cardboard chairs, cardboard tables, cardboard kitchen over there, and a bathroom just there.
Yes.
Is the material just because it was quite easy to use, or is it supposed to give a sense of impermanence?
I think impermanence is very important for this project. The overall title for this biennale is Common Ground. And what is a common ground? You can actually approach this idea of common ground with several different aspects. The way you behave, society in general, bourgeoisie, or the material that you're dealing with every day. And these two materials are the most common material that has been used in Taiwan, for instance. This paper, corrugated paper, it's paper carton paper, meaning that it's a container. And this nylon rope is what we use to tie the instant noodle or boxes, for instance, that we use every day. These are the two most ordinary material we use in Taiwan. One was used as a container to carry things, that we transformed this perception or the use of this material into something low-bearing, became something brick-like. Yet at the same time, it's ephemeral, it's not permanent. And the nylon side, the nylon rope as well, is a very linear, something you tighten thing up, but here it's being applied as a surface, as something to give you a sense of enclosure.
And so the house structure is made of cardboard, and then there's this sort of nylon webbing that goes up and connects it to a frame.
Yeah.
And it's a very beautiful, ethereal experience to be in here. But I wonder, is it trying to challenge the sort of traditional notion of home as people feel in Taiwan?
Home, as one can understand, is where you feel most comfortable of yourself, basically. And everyone has a facade. Your house is a facade. And this is the answer to this facade. What is the facade? Facade is your, it's a shelter to protect you from outside, as well as the connection between you and outside. And this part of exhibition is about the interpretation of what is a facade. Facade is this connection to this Pujani. It's this connection to the context. It's this connection between we as a, what is the function inside and to the context outside. And this is a, this physical connection, you know, and this facade has become a space rather than a skin.
And what do you hope that people visiting this will take away from it?
Transitory, something in between, something that creates doubt of what we are, who we are, and how we live in general.
That was Taiwanese architect Michael Johan Lin in the Palazzo delle Prigioni in Venice there. And from a cardboard house to a room filled with seesaws. You'd be forgiven for thinking this Biennale was one big children's playground. But the seesaws were in fact part of the Irish Pavilion. The long wooden constructions invited visitors to sit and play with other strangers. It was, of course, rather fun, a welcome relief from some of the denser shows, but was it really architecture? Here's Irish architect and curator Roisin Hennigan from Dublin Practice Hennigan Peng to tell us more.
We're interested in looking at was in measure, in scale, in general, which is such an important concept in architecture, but we use this the seesaw as a way that something that people can interact with. It's a series of six interlinked benches. One person sits on it, it generates momentum through the thing that starts to move. And what we've found over the last year or two is that people sit on it and then they start talking to somebody saying, push down a bit, or it's like, oh, I'm so heavy. But it starts conversations, which is kind of a very nice byproduct. What we were looking at is, it's kind of something so fundamental to architecture, weight and scale and how it affects design. And then the drawings look at it in a slightly different way, which is a series of stone drawings that were a byproduct of the size that was possible from the stone. And the way they're set out is they're actually densest around the points of the bench where you have the fulcrum, which is the point of greatest force. So they graphically show the force, the greatest force.
So the notion of common ground, which is the theme that David Chipperfield has set, is it as simple here as getting people to interact and talk?
Yeah, it really is. We're at the end of the show in a way. So it's a bench. And it's a place people can sit and they talk. And it is that simple, you know. So there's a whole lot of other ideas there, but at a very fundamental level, it's kind of trying to make a space for people to have an exchange. Yeah.
And tell me a little bit about the practice and the work that you're doing outside of the Biennale.
Well, we are based in Dublin, but we did the Central Park bridges at the Olympic Park, which was a very colourful bridge at the, with a circular, people called it the Doughty Bridge. We're doing the School of Architecture at the University of Greenwich in London. And we're doing the Grand Egyptian Museum in Cairo. And we did the Giant's Causeway Visitor Centre in Northern Ireland, which is what you see the drawings of here.
And just talking about the Biennale in general, what do you think people will take away from it? Is it just for architects, or is it something that actually can engage the wider public a little bit more, help them to think about architecture and how it impacts everybody? It's not just sort of lofty discipline that people might think it is.
I hope that it's for everybody, because I do really, really believe that architecture is very important. It's really what makes the space of our cities, the places we live in. I think some of the exhibits deal with that. And in a way, I suppose, this is a bit playful because we wanted it to be more than just for architects, but also have an architectural theme there, but as a way to start drawing people in to engage with some of the things that architects deal with.
That was Roisin Hennigan there, keeping her balance on the seesaws at the Irish Pavilion. And that brings us to the end of this week's Venice Architecture Biennale special edition of Section D. It's time to leave the watery shores behind and return to the more solid ground of London. Next week, we'll be finding out what will happen to all the furniture from the Olympic site, now the Games have gone.
We'll also head to the top of the Shard to talk swimming pools with views with Hong Kong designer Andre Fu. And we'll drop in on a young design studio in the West Bank capital of Ramallah with keen green ambitions. This week's show was produced by Gillian Tobias and edited by Holly Fisher. I'm Hugo MacDonald, and playing you out with one last watery Italian flourish, this is Waves of Love by Italian group Isolate. Thank you for listening. Ciao e arrivederci.